Chobanov, Yordanov, and a circle of other Bulgarian journalists sit around a table at a cafe in the sunny Bulgarian resort town of Arvada. Chobanov has been leading a training session on using encryption, Tor, and proxy services for reporters to protect sources and themselves. Now they're drinking beer at noon, eating fried shrimp pulled from the Black Sea nearby, and swapping dirty jokes in Bulgarian. They translate one for me that involves Vladimir Putin, Dmitry Medvedev, and a prostitute. Chobanov is sitting next to Yordanov, looking rather tiny beside his heftier, square-bodied partner. The smaller of the two Balkan leakers is wearing the Beevil t-shirt with a buffalo again, so I ask him why his news site uses the animal as its symbol. It's Yordanov who answers. The bulkier Bulgarian wears a pair of very scuffed, knock-off Oakley sunglasses, a half-week's worth of thick stubble, and a black shirt tucked over a barrel chest into black shorts, sandals, and a leather case for his cell phone on his belt. He looks, to my ignorant American eyes, like a caricature of an Eastern European mafia thug on holiday. The buffalo is a very special animal, the 53-year-old reporter intones slowly with a thick Slavic accent. It is the most intelligent animal, much more intelligent than a dog, and has a perfect memory. Once there was a baby buffalo that was beaten very badly by a man. He continues in a manner that leaves it unspoken whether he is telling a story from personal experience or as a kind of Aesop's fable. It grew up, and 8 years later, it left the herd one day. When it was found, it had killed the man and trampled him so that you couldn't recognize him. The buffalo had smelled the man from 15 kilometers away. So in this way, we're like the buffalo, Yordanov concludes without expression. We do not forgive, we do not forget, explains Chobanov with a silly grin, borrowing the anonymous hacker's slogan. Chobanov had mentioned to me in passing that Yordanov had been a cowboy and raised buffalo before becoming an investigative journalist. So I ask how it was that he ended up on that unlikely career path. There's a long pause. Then Yordanov speaks. And I can sense from the silence around the table that I've now touched on the wrong topic for a sunny lunchtime discussion. I was 24 years old, and I was married to a woman that I loved very much. And I discovered that my wife, this woman who I loved more than anything in the world, was an agent of the secret police, he says simply. She was spying on me in my own home. So that's why I left the city and became a cowboy. I dropped the subject, seemingly to the relief of everyone present. But a few hours later, during another break in the training session, Arsen Yordanov tells me his story. In the 1930s and 1940s, Yordanov's grandfather was a general in the Bulgarian resistance, leading thousands of guerrilla troops, fighting in the country's southeastern mountains against the Nazis and the official Bulgarian government that had allied with them. But even after Bulgaria switched to the Allied side near the end of the war and later became a Soviet satellite state, the communist government distrusted Yordanov's grandfather's political power. On the 28th of March, 1947, Yordanov's grandfather's personal doctor gave him what seemed to be a routine medical injection. He died half an hour later, while his 27-year-old wife and 7-year-old son, Arsen Yordanov's father, watched. An autopsy was never performed. Yordanov's grandmother was asked to sign a statement that cut all ties with her dead husband. She refused. So she and her family remained enemies of the state, shunned and ignored even by their neighbors for close to a decade. Arsen Yordanov grew up with only a shadow of those years hanging over his childhood. His father had become a man of letters and a famous poet within Bulgaria, and the younger Yordanov sailed through school, publishing poems and essays in the local newspaper. He graduated from Konstantin Preslavsky University with high marks and performed his military service with distinction in the region of the country close to the Turkish border. Yordanov mostly stayed away from politics, but he didn't hide his hatred of the communist regime. I knew our society was heading toward a dead end, and I wasn't afraid to say so, he says. While he worked toward his master's degree in Bulgarian literature and philology, he took a job as an audio and video engineer in the local Burgas Theater. It was there he met a petite Turkish actress, a very pretty 24-year-old with short dark hair and brown eyes. He asked her to marry him 3 days later. They had been husband and wife for 1 year when a friend in the government called Yordanov and asked to meet for a walk in Burgas Park. There, the agitated friend told him about a detailed report he had stumbled upon and asked him to promise that he would never reveal his source. The report was written by Yordanov's wife under the pseudonym Christina. She was a paid informant of the same secret services that had engineered the murder of his grandfather. For the last year, she had monitored and reported every word he and his parents had said, the books he read, the jokes he told his friends. What I found out, I didn't know what was real or false, what was true and what was a lie. The thinking in my head turned to marmalade, Yordanov says. He stumbled out of the park in a state of dazed denial. Yordanov says his wife rejected his accusations, then confessed, then collapsed and cried for forgiveness. She promised to end her work for the Secret Services, which had begun 6 years earlier during her years as a student in Sofia. But I knew that once you're part of this system, you can't get out, he says. It's not a disease that can be cured. He felt betrayed by Bulgarian society at the deepest level, so he simply left it behind. Yordanov divorced his wife and began a period of wandering in the Stranja Mountains. He passed through communities where only handfuls of people lived and eventually settled in a village of about 30 people, taking up residence in an abandoned building on its outskirts. He had no access to electricity, carried all the water he used up a cliff face half a mile away, and stopped cutting his beard or hair. He went months without speaking. I never wanted to see a human face again, he says. I wanted to live by different laws, to escape the laws of man. To sustain himself, Yordanov worked as a shepherd in a cooperative farm. With no expenses, he eventually saved enough to buy 3 cows, a buffalo, and later 10 sheep and 3 goats, and began selling their milk. Feed suppliers who learned that he was an enemy of the state refused to sell to him, so he grew his own oats, beans, corn, and alfalfa, hiring locals to help tend the crops. After his first year as a cowboy, he left his bare-bones shelter and went into the forest to live with his herd. When the animals wandered wild, he wandered with them, riding horses and sometimes training and riding the buffalo themselves. He slept occasionally in a shack he found in the woods, more often on the ground, in caves or in trees, wherever he was when night fell. Eventually, his itinerant farm grew to more than 150 animals. Yordanov spent nearly 5 years this way. He would receive mail and occasional phone calls from the nearest village once a week. And then in late 1992, he got word from his 73-year-old grandmother that his father was moving to Sofia. So he sold his beloved herd and returned to the city to take care of her. Back in Burgas, he found that Bulgarian society was utterly transformed, on its surface, if not at its corrupted core. The communist regime that had wrecked his life had been disassembled and reassembled in the hands of several well-connected oligarchs. The Darjavna Sigurnost Secret Service had evaporated its name, and many of the same faces had found their way into the new government. For a year, he lived in a state of culture shock, taking temporary jobs in construction and as a dock worker at the port of Burgas, with no ambition or direction. And then a friend told him about a job opening at the Denevan Trud, or Labor Daily, the country's biggest newspaper. With his father's name and his education in literature, Yordanov got the job. Within months, Yordanov discovered he had a gift for eliciting bombshell stories from sources. With me, people seem to feel that they can tell me anything without danger, he says simply. He showed unusual fearlessness in publishing articles about mafia murders, government corruption, and the privatization of the country's resources, and soon he was seen as one of Bulgaria's top muckrakers in the eastern part of the country. During the Yugoslavian wars of the mid-1990s, Serbia had been struck with an international embargo. As a result, Bulgaria's eastern coast across the Black Sea from Russia became a lucrative smuggling gateway. In 1994, Yordanov established through confidential sources that the Burgas airport was being used in a complex scheme involving local mafia and the government, with undeclared tankers arriving laden with oil, cigarettes, weapons, and gold, and being registered at the airport rather than the port to hide their cargo. He published the 8-page story in Standard Weekly and immediately faced a series of defamation suits. All were eventually dropped, and the chief customs officer of Burgas was indicted on smuggling charges and convicted. The next year, Yordanov got a tip that a factory north of Burgas was being used for illegal cigarette production. He gained access to the building in the middle of the night, took pictures, and published the story. Soon after, he received his first death threat, a letter delivered by messenger that suggested he reserve a place in the cemetery for his tomb. The police raided the factory and shut it down, and began a 2-year investigation against the politicians and businessmen involved, which mysteriously ended without arrests. Yordanov suddenly interrupts his storytelling. The sun has set, and he's taken off his sunglasses to reveal a pair of deep-set and sad eyes. "I want to stop here and say something," he says. "One of those men involved in this factory that I exposed was Boyko Borisov. Today, he is the Prime Minister of Bulgaria. And 16 years ago, I showed that he is a criminal." A scent of death bleeds into the scent of Christmas, begins Birgitte Jonsdottir's illustrated memoir, The Chameleon's Diary. Sewing together childhood dreams and memories, she tells the story of a small girl with black hair and pale skin in the tiny Icelandic fishing village of Thorlákshöfn, who ran up and down the slippery, rotting black wood at the edges of the pier, using her mother's violin bow as a fishing pole and terrifying the old men who worked on the wharf. Jonsdottir's mother, Bergdóra Árnadóttir, had moved to the town of 800 Icelanders to escape Jonsdottir's mentally disturbed birth father, whom Árnadóttir had married at the age of 16. The mother and the 4-year-old daughter soon met her stepfather, a kind, sturdy fishing boat captain with long sideburns and one of the biggest houses in the village. It was the young Jonsdottir, not her mother, who brought up the idea of marriage. "I proposed to him," she says. "I got down on my knees and asked him to be my father." Jonsdottir would remain close to her stepfather even after her parents divorced a few years later, and she says he taught her lessons she would remember. He lived simply and honestly, paid his employees before himself, and carried no debts. She called him the Fisher King. Árnadóttir was a well-known folk singer who organized a monthly music night in Reykjavik, and her daughter grew up surrounded by artists, musicians, and writers. Jonsdottir pored over her grandparents' books on Tibetan Buddhism and the American spiritualist Edgar Cayce. As she grew into her teens, she discovered the punk scene and its roots in anarchist politics. Her mother recorded her first album at the same recording studio as Björk during the recording of the Icelandic pop star's premiere record. Jonsdottir remembers that once, while her mother strummed her guitar and sang, the two teenagers whispered secrets to each other in the studio's attic. Surrounded by uncompromising artists and writers from that young age, Jonsdottir says she never had much use for conformity. She bought a second-hand tuxedo jacket with long tails and painted an enormous anarchist symbol on its back in orange. When her mother entered her into a youth modeling competition, she responded by cutting her hair into a towering black mohawk. She blew the whistle on her sexually abusive teacher. And when a school trip took her class to visit a Coca-Cola factory and then the Icelandic Parliament building, the Altinka, she refused to go inside. Instead, the 14-year-old sat on the school bus and wrote a poem about a nuclear holocaust with an eyeliner pencil on a paper bag. It was called Svartar Rosir, or Black Roses, and was later published in the newspaper Helkar Posturin. I look out the window and see collapsed houses, it reads in English. I look out the window and I see streams of blood. I look out the window and I see the black ashes and remains of human bodies. This is all that's left of our humanity. One stormy Christmas Eve, just before the traditional 6 o'clock Icelandic Christmas dinner, Jónsdóttir's stepfather arrived at her grandparents' home in Kvaerketha, dropped off her younger brother, then abruptly plunged back into the blizzard, saying he needed to deliver a package to a friend's place. The next day, he was still missing. The police found his car next to a river, a 10-minute drive away from the village. There was no body or suicide note, but the police concluded that he must have drowned himself in the icy flows. My father, the Fisher King, killed himself last night. I pictured him in my mind's eye walking heavily into the river, a little bit bent. A lone dark shadow in a blizzard of white, she would write. I have to remain strong. I have erected an iron raft in my back. It will not bend. In the months that followed, Jónsdóttir's mother moved to Denmark in a state of near emotional collapse, and Jónsdóttir followed her there to care for her. The young woman entered a state of self-imposed exile, painting, writing, and reflection that she describes as a walk through the valley of the shadows. Her first volume of poetry, Frostinklar, or Icicles, was published the next year. When she returned to Iceland to launch the book, she met a handsome, sensitive young Icelandic-American photographer with large brown eyes and thick black hair that fell over his forehead. The 22-year-old Jónsdóttir was given a grant by Iceland's government to stay in Reykjavik and write a book a year, an idea that struck her as deathly boring. Her photographer boyfriend, on the other hand, wanted to return to the United States to reconnect with his American father and asked her to come with him. To avoid immigration hassles, they were married, and 6 weeks after the birth of their son, they moved to West Virginia. After a few weeks there, the new family put their belongings into a trailer and took a road trip across the country, finally settling in Medford, New Jersey, where Jónsdóttir sold Kirby vacuum cleaners door-to-door to pay the bills while writing and painting. When she had had enough of hawking payment plans to poor suburbanites who couldn't afford them, they returned to Iceland. But back in their homeland, another problem was coming to a head. Before the birth of their son, Jónsdóttir's husband had begun to suffer from grand mal seizures. Doctors diagnosed him with epilepsy and prescribed drugs that left him vacant, deeply depressed, and sapped of creativity. Early one morning, he told Jónsdóttir he was leaving for work and disappeared. She found a note from him when she woke up an hour later. Can you forgive a desperate soul? Despite a manhunt that covered much of Western Iceland, it would be another half decade before his weathered and smooth bones were found in a field of moss on Snæfellsnes Peninsula, to the north of Reykjavik, in a suicide that mirrored her stepfather's. 15 years later, when Iceland found itself in one of the deepest financial crises in the world's history, Jónsdóttir would write that the long smoldering tragedies of her early life had served as preparation for the country's hour of reckoning. This morning I realized why I had been given these lessons of living in suspense without going quite mad or losing my integrated sense of optimism, she would write in her blog. I was being prepared for the times we are facing on my nearly bankrupted island. After her husband's death, Jónsdóttir buried herself in her usual creative outlets for her grief: words, images, and ideas. But she also discovered a new one that tied them all together: the internet. While working at a temporary job at Iceland's first internet ad agency, she was amused to see that the company's designers had left a typo on its website, in the word proofreading, no less. When she couldn't get anyone at the firm to fix it, she learned HTML and corrected it herself, then began making her own sites, mixing poetry, paintings, and video. Soon she and two other early web obsessives named Kunar Crimson and Kuthmandur Kuthmansen formed a group called InterOrgan, or I.O., a kind of web art collective. Io is the most volcanically active moon in the solar system. The friction from the forces pulling on it creates all this heat inside. It was a very appropriate name, says Kuthmansen. He and Crimson and Jonsdottir pushed the boundaries of the internet with some of the web's first live audio and video. If it was new, we did it, he says. If it already worked, we weren't interested. One of Jonsdottir's sites, at its peak, received enough traffic to account for 60% of the country's bandwidth. When Jonsdottir wasn't programming, she was protesting. She organized demonstrations against the construction of the Karanyukur Dam in the east of the country, which threatened to swallow up some of the country's most beautiful waterfalls to power aluminum smelters. She found the phone numbers of the handful of Icelandic Tibetans in Reykjavik and organized a series of Free Tibet protests in front of the Chinese embassy. And in 2003, she led protests against the build-up to the invasion of Iraq. Writing poems that vented her frustration at political lies and the mass media's blindness as it stumbled toward a seemingly preordained war. One was titled The Horror of War. Mountains of starved children, shiny bones, burning flesh. These are images we should put in a frame, mount them in our homes, so we never forget the true horror of war. For Jonsdottir, protest became practically a way of life, even when her fellow demonstrators could be counted on a single hand. Then, in October 2008, the whole of Iceland was suddenly protesting beside her. Iceland's banks had been deregulated in 2001 and privatized in 2003 under the Milton Friedman-influenced leadership of Prime Minister Davíð Oddsson. With Viking zeal, the country had adopted some of the most highly leveraged, riskiest banking practices in the world. In a few years, the assets of the country's financial industry grew from 100% of the country's gross domestic product to 1,000%. And then, at the height of those bankers' hubris, the international credit crisis hit. As the banks failed to repay their mountains of short-term debt, they collapsed and were nationalized in a panic. The stock market value of Icelandic companies fell 90%. Luxury properties being built in Reykjavik with make-believe money were halted mid-construction. Customers defaulted on their expensive car loans they had taken as their savings winked out of existence. Iceland's obligations to international depositors in one bank alone, Landsbanki, were roughly as damaging to its economy as the reparations Germany had been forced to pay in its crippling Treaty of Versailles after World War I. Icelanders revolted. The protests began every Saturday outside the Alþingi and grew from hundreds to thousands. They banged on pots and pans, replaced the parliament's flag with that of a corporate grocery store chain, and at one point nearly managed to storm the building. Word of the demonstrations and organizational details spread through Facebook, where almost half of all Icelanders had accounts, more per capita than any other country. The first Facebook revolution didn't happen in Tunisia or Egypt, says Robert Marshall, a former journalist who now serves as a member of the Icelandic parliament. It happened here. 3 months later, when it became clear that the crowds would paralyze the country before they gave up, the government resigned. An election was scheduled. In the chaos of that interregnum, Icelanders began meeting in small groups to discuss what they wanted from the new government. Jonsdottir was a regular at one of those makeshift assemblies at the Reykjavik Academy, and it quickly grew into a political party, the Citizens' Movement. It had a handful of goals, such as keeping the International Monetary Fund out of Iceland and increasing direct democracy. But it vowed to use a hit-and-run strategy. Whether or not it could achieve those goals, it planned to dissolve after 8 years, a short enough time that it couldn't be corrupted. When Jonsdottir volunteered to run for parliament as part of that subversive political party, its poll numbers showed that it would receive half of 1% of the vote. It seemed like a suicide mission, says Markrit Trygvadottir, another of the candidates. The citizens' movement was largely ignored by the mainstream media. But through its visibility on Facebook, in blogs, and Twitter, and by virtue of the electorate's vast anger toward Iceland's existing parties, it steadily rose in popularity. They finagled their way into the candidate debates, where Jónsdóttir cut a fiery figure. "We used a kind of hacker mentality," she says. "We found the cracks in the system where we could get our voices heard." In the election that April, more than a third of the country's representatives were replaced with candidates who had never held office before. 7% of the vote went to the citizens' movement, enough to give the party 4 seats in the legislature. One of those seats belonged to Birgitta Jónsdóttir. Long before Atanas Chobanov ever thought he could take an active part in the leaking movement, he pioneered another method of hacktivism: text message terrorism. Chobanov had known since his teen years that Sofia was simply not a place where his brand of free thinking could exist. He refused to join the local Communist Party and was fired from the low-level industrial job he had been forced into by the Bulgarian government. When the Iron Curtain parted in 1989, he got a fellowship at Paris West University and moved to Paris's Latin Quarter without hesitation. Chobanov went on to get a PhD in linguistics and became a skilled computer scientist, analyzing large databases of spoken and written word to find the fundamental underpinnings of human language. But as Bulgarian news began to trickle across the border via the growing online news media, he found his native country's political problems harder to ignore, and also saw his opportunity to help. In 2004, he created an NGO for Bulgarians living abroad and became the editor of the Bulgaria-focused Parizhny Vesti, or Paris News, attacking what he calls the country's slow and stupid administration and highlighting issues like a wasteful, no-bid, 35-year-old highway contract proposed in 2006. "It was my small way of fighting for normality," he says. One of the issues that infuriated Chobanov most was a health care tax that was applied to all Bulgarians. Both the 7 million that lived in the country and the 1 million or so that had emigrated since the fall of the Soviet Union. Even those who paid for health care abroad still had to fork out the equivalent of thousands of dollars or risk paying an accumulated fine if they ever set foot in the country again. The law made less sense than ever after Bulgaria's 2007 accession to the European Union. But despite immense anger from expats, the unresponsive parliament had no incentive to dial down or delete a tax that affected those who couldn't vote against them. Just before Christmas in 2008, one Bulgarian newspaper made the mistake of publishing the cell phone numbers of every member of the country's parliament in a feel-good invitation to the country's citizens to send them Happy New Year text messages. Chobanov seized the opportunity, forwarding the list to thousands of Bulgarians around the world, calling on them to send SMS messages demanding the tax be lifted. Soon, more than 10,000 petitioners flooded the parliamentarians' inboxes with as many as 90 texts each in a day, paralyzing their phones in a legal version of the same attacks Anonymous would use to take down Visa's and MasterCard's websites. Newspapers and lawmakers denounced the tactic and called it SMS terrorism. One member of parliament, who was pushing a bill to repeal the tax, issued a public apology to the parliament. But Chobanov won. The anti-tax bill passed. Today, he laughs off the use of the word terrorism to describe his cell phone subterfuge. "People paying lawmakers' salaries have the right to contact them," he says with a shrug. Back in Bulgaria, Yordanov was fighting other battles, without the 1,000 miles of buffer between Paris and Sofia to protect him. In 2007, he and fellow reporter Maria Nikolaeva at the newspaper Politika dug into a political decision that would allow a swath of ecologically protected coastal land 12 miles north of Burgas to have its protection stripped, be bought on the cheap, and turned into a lucrative holiday resort. Other patches of the former nature reserve were distributed to public officials, their families, and even the police officer responsible for investigating possible ethics violations by the mayor who had removed the land's protected status. The two reporters prepared a series of front-page stories for Politica, exposing the allegedly corrupt deals, titling the series the Crusade Against Stranja. When the first article appeared, Nikolaeva received a visit from two men in the paper's Sofia office. They dropped the day's paper on her desk and made some offhand remarks about the building's security. "You know full well that you shouldn't write things like this," they said. "And you know what happens to curious journalists? They get acid thrown at them." The two were referring to Anna Zarkova, a reporter for the Denevan Trude, who had sulfuric acid splashed on her face and body at a Sofia bus stop in 1998 after publishing a story on Bulgarian human trafficking. Her left eye was so badly damaged that it had to be surgically removed. The paper's surveillance camera caught the license plate of the men's car who had threatened Nikolaeva, and the footage was submitted to the police. No arrests were made. She and Yordanov refused to back down. Instead, Nikolaeva made as many television appearances and gave as many newspaper interviews as possible to try and publicize the threat against her. After that first installment in the series, Yordanov learned that someone in Burgas was trying a different censorship tactic, purchasing every issue of the paper from the distributor before it could be delivered to newsstands. When the next issue came out, he drove to the distributor early in the morning, filled his car with papers, and handed them out himself to local retailers. Yordanov's brazenness didn't go unnoticed. It would nearly cost him his life.